Hello, everyone. This is Roger Hurst from Real Vision, and I'm here with Freddie Brick of Muddy Waters and Zeros TV. And we're going to talk about some of the big things that have been going on in the commodity markets, and particularly some of the incredible moves we've seen and what it means for supply chains and some of the implications it has probably down the road. So we just wanted to sort of really just get our heads around this, because I'm sure everyone's been seeing some of the stories in the press, and some of them have been quite remarkable, Freddie. I mean, have there been any ones that have really sort of piqued your fantasy or your interest over the last few days?
Yeah, Roger, look, thank you very much for joining us today. I think we've seen one of the biggest moves in commodities as an asset class, to my knowledge, in the last 20, 30 years. I think you have to go back to perhaps the Iran crisis to really look at anything similar. For me, there's been a bunch of different dimensions to his. There's been the individual stories of great fortunes made and lost. There's been the global liquidity picture, which I really want to touch on because I think that's of great importance to all investors. And then there's the ESG dynamic, which is playing into this in a way that we've never seen before. So to tackle sort of maybe one of the first ones, I want to talk about Peabody Coal. So for those of you who aren't aware, Peabody is a coal company listed in the US, and they put out a press release, it was either late last week or early this week, explaining how they had to tap an emergency line, which Goldman Sachs kindly provided at the princely interest rate of 10%, in order to meet margin calls due to the positioning of their book, where they are short the paper market to hedge off their physical contracts. And that dynamic is something we were somewhat aware of, having looked at some of the commodity players when we rode on Noble Group back in mid-2015. And it's this fascinating dynamic where most people think commodity traders are long everything and higher prices are better for them. But what the reality is that higher prices often require significant increases in working capital. And therefore, when you get these sudden moves, you have a mismatch between the physical market and the paper market that's being hedged. That's one of the areas that I think is particularly interesting. And I know it's an area that you are quite intimately familiar with, and how this affects liquidity, both at the trading houses and also the banks. So, you know, I'd love to hear your thoughts on how you see that playing out.
Yeah, I mean, the moves have been remarkable. I think for the Bloomberg Commodity Spot Index, it's the biggest one-week swing ever, biggest one-week rise ever. Similarly, I think we've seen some of the biggest one-week moves ever in wheat. And all these moves are really, you know, obviously we know what the catalyst is. It's the invasion of Ukraine, but these are basically people cutting positions. These are short squeezes, and then we're seeing the reverse. So, you know, on the opening day, on Monday, I think it was the 8th of March, we saw Brent crude oil hit 139 pretty much on the opening print. 2 days later, it fell 19% intraday. You've seen, obviously, this enormous move on nickel. I mean, it makes all the other ones look like a birthday present, because this one was seriously big. It went from 25,000 to 50,000, and then up to 100,000, although we'll come to that a bit later. Because apparently that didn't actually happen. And what this is, as you say, you know, the commodity markets are really very much based around two things: spot markets, which is the actual movement shipment of the goods, and then the commodities producers and the major players hedging themselves in the forward market or the futures market. And as you said, that's exactly what's happened here. We've seen nearly every short hedge that most of the sensible players would have had on, but also some of the sensible players turned out to be not quite so sensible. And these things moved significantly, creating these massive margin calls. And it's, you know, it's probably the only asset class really where higher prices are nearly always bad, whereas nearly every other asset class, higher prices are pretty much seen as good. And people always say that you see a bottom in an equity market with a V and a top in a commodity market with an inverse V. So these have been some pretty shocking moves, and they have these reverberations. There's two of them, two main ones, which is all the brokers who have these positions on are the ones who ultimately have to get the margin from their end clients and post it with the clearing houses. And most of these brokers would have found themselves well short of some of the numbers that were required. So that's, you know, are there any defaults in some of the minor brokers, or as we'll come on to, has there been some rearranging of the chairs to make sure that nobody goes down with the ship? And then the other thing that I think is probably more important on the longer term, which is this whole thing is there's a series of very, very complex, it's a very, very complex global web of connectivity in how these things are paid, because you don't take a commodity somewhere and someone pays you at that point in time. There is a forward market. There are people who deliver and expect payment later. And one of the biggest players who has, you know, between them, between Ukraine and Russia, but particularly Russia, has 20% or nearly 20% of some of the key commodities. They've just been taken out of the chain. Have they already paid everybody? Do they owe lots of people? And have they therefore taken people out of that chain? So there is a potential house of cards here. It's that could unravel. Not unlike things that we saw in 2008, where you sort of think, okay, one bit's gone, but then a few weeks later, bodies start to float to the surface. So there is a very big risk that if you take a lot of the key pivots, key points out of this chain, suddenly the liquidity within that chain dries up. And furthermore, a lot of these commodities are also used as collateral for other types of business, and you're taking that out of the chain as well. So there is a very, very significant risk to large parts of the global economy if this chain has been disrupted in a significant way. And some of these price moves would suggest it has.
The chain aspect of this is also something I find fascinating. In the middle of this week, Congress decided to officially ban imports of Russian crude. Now, while that generated a lot of headlines, some work that we had done looking at this the week before suggests that it was somewhat of a moot point, because despite not having explicitly banned the importing of crude, in the week before, because of this chain that takes place, whether it's, you know, being able to finance an LC with a bank, being able to actually pay the trader because Russia had been removed from SWIFT, whether it was financing the underlying ship itself in order to bring the cargo, that had all already frozen. And what really struck me about that was people were being so careful not to touch that chain that not only did Russian crude trade at a discount to benchmark, but you even saw countries where there was potential for there to be some Russian crude in the pipeline. So I believe Kazakh oil was also trading at about a $9 discount. You know, as far as I'm aware, we've never really seen that. I think you kind of have to go back to Mark Rich-esque early days of Glencore taking crude from embargoed nations, transshipping, relabeling things, you know, to my mind, before I've seen those kind of discounts in spot markets. And, you know, I think what was incredibly interesting and ultimately the story that kind of really emerged was what we saw happen with Shell. So Shell were, in order to perform on delivery, they actually sought permission from the government, and I'm unclear as to which government it was, to effectively buy embargoed crude in order to deliver it, because otherwise they were going to have to pay a large penalty as a result of the way these contracts are structured. And they very generously gave the proceeds of this to charity, which maybe some of the trading houses have not done. And so that for me was kind of this fascinating part of the supply chain. So while the headline was that crude was banned, essentially, once you took Russia out of SWIFT and you made it persona non grata, you almost didn't need to explicitly ban the import of crude for this whole part of the chain to fall apart.
Yeah, and look, what's interesting is that with a lot of these big moves that we've seen, you know, you'd have thought that have happened on the invasion, but they didn't. They took a while. It was probably as a response eventually, as you say, to being turned off from SWIFT, and then eventually it started to move through the system. I mean, it was effective the days after these sort of monumental steps were taken. And it's this whole liquidity story that is permeating through the global supply chain right now. And it's, you know, there's the liquidity of the supply chain, and then the actual supply chain itself all coming under threat because one of the most important players has been taken out, and one of the most important financiers in terms of Russia providing a lot of liquidity to those chains. So it is a very significant future risk, which I think we haven't seen the end of. I think there's going to be more of these eye-popping moves in some of these commodities, because there will be other areas where, you know, down the road, somebody who should be receiving a payment for commodity X, but it's actually bigger in commodity Y, suddenly realizes that they haven't got the money to pay margin on a commodity that's probably not even one of the ones directly impacted by what's going on in Ukraine, but they are indirectly impacted because of this very, very intricate web of financing. So it's got potential to a very bad bid offer here, but it's got the potential on one hand to be like a Lehman or a combined Russia and LTCM crisis. On the other hand, it's got the potential to be like Y2K, which came and went without anybody really batting an eyelid. So, you know, it's a bus wide and bigger bid offer on this. But nobody knows. This is an unknowable thing, but everyone's got to be aware that it could be, you know, the sort of area where we see liquidity significantly compromised.
So, you know, not to mark the bid-ask spread, I think it's a fair point, given a large part of that will probably depend on how governments respond to these dislocations. You know, one thing I found particularly interesting this week was the nickel market, which you touched on. My understanding is either there was a paper position to partially hedge a physical position, but potentially there was also a paper position there as pure speculation. At the point of peak dislocation, the LME, which I think is owned actually by the Hong Kong Exchange, so that in of itself probably begs some questions as to how a Chinese trader was dealt with versus other market participants. But the LME actually suspended operations, and I believe is not currently open at the timing of recording. Some Chinese banks, I believe, have put up the margin, and there's an intent to have an orderly sort of unwind of the position. Look, to call it what it is, I mean, they are cancelling trades that took place on Tuesday. It's pretty fucked up. You know, can you think of an instance where, you know, other than maybe the flash crash, which we saw, I mean, can you remember when trades have been cancelled like that? And an exchange has been stopped in a, you know, otherwise orderly function.
Yeah, I think last time they're saying it's the biggest crisis for the LME since tin. The tin market was cornered by a cartel, and I think that went against them, and they had to close it down. Margin calls all over the place. I think that was 1985, something like that. So I don't actually really remember it because I was doing other things at the time. But this was an incredible thing because, you know, we saw this doubling in the price. I'd heard that it was 100,000 ton short. And so what we saw is effectively 25,000 to 50,000 to 100,000. So let's say you were longer 12, let's say longer 25,000. That was 75,000 on 100,000 tons. That's quite a big margin call. And obviously initial margin would have been going through the roof as well with that right. Volatility. So what's interesting is that the trades were cancelled. So there's obviously a lot of people who were the winners, who were legitimate winners of those trades. And we don't maybe want to call it that, but ultimately there were people who had legitimate long positions on. Those have been cancelled. And there is this concept where you're not supposed to fix the price, and the price has been fixed. Now, you can say there should have been some checks and balances in place, which they've belatedly put in place now, 10% price limits. If those were in place beforehand, that would have been fine because that everyone would have known the rules. But these are rules that are being changed retrospectively. So it does now make you wonder, okay, you know, when you're trading on exchanges, who do the rules apply to and will they apply to you? And if I have a bad day, will I get let off? It's not really a market anymore when that happens.
Yeah, you know, for me, especially when it comes to liquidity, that is a theme that seems to repeat itself. You know, at the depths of March 2020, when we saw massive dislocations in the treasury market, which were essentially the result of, you know, what I understand to have mostly been multi-manager platforms taking very large levered basis trades, which was starting to move against them significantly. You know, we saw freezing up potentially in the CLO market, which finances a lot of buyouts. You know, you get into these positions where someone who is quote unquote too big to fail, and for the most part, spend most of the time lobbying against regulation and interference from government or regulatory bodies saying, well, this was a one-off. You know, this was a 100-year storm, which sort of happens every 6, 8, 10, 12 years, pick a number. And I think it encourages really bad behavior. I mean, the lesson from this, if you're a commodity trader, is look, get as big as you humanly can. And if you're going to make a mistake, you definitely don't want to make it in kind of $100 million or $1 billion size. I mean, you want to make it in like $10 billion size, and then they'll just hold the market and we can unwind this and bring in some banks and we can all sit down and work out how to make you whole.
Yeah, what's really interesting about this whole period that we've got into at the moment, which is that clearly there is within that environment, the too big to fail, which was supposed to have been dealt with in 2008, has clearly not been dealt with. And yet we're getting this sort of strange sort of change in some corporate behavior, which is interesting, because on the one hand, you've got that corporate behavior. You talked about Shell, which is maybe a little bit sort of, okay, we shouldn't have really done that maybe. But then also there's a lot of actors today, which we wouldn't have done 2 weeks ago, are actually taking effectively a moral high ground rather than economic low ground, which is what they normally do, which is going to be very interesting, because by doing that, it changes a lot of the factors that central bank and policymakers that we just talked about have to take into account, which is normally their economic actors. So it's interesting. Is this going to actually see a better morality at the corporate level, or is this just a one-off as well? Because, you know, we've seen in the rising market for the last 10 years that you're pretty much allowed to get away with anything. And today, actually, some of the big corporates have said, actually, we've got to take this on the chin. We've got to take some pain this time around, which is very unusual. Normally, everybody's pushing as hard as they can to not take any pain whatsoever. But the sea change seemed to be so big this time that many have felt that way. I don't know whether this makes things better going forward, but, you know, when you're fixing prices still and letting people off, then it's still a bit two-way there.
It is interesting, the shunning of, I mean, we saw, you know, especially within the last couple of years, we've had banks moving away from financing commodities. We've had, significant amount of government policy directed to greener energy. I would dispute how green some of it actually is if you look at the entire value chain, but certainly stuff that doesn't come out of chimneys and look smoky. And now we've kind of seen, to a certain extent, the results of that when we do have these supply shocks. And I think the other thing I'd be curious to get your opinion on is, while we have a lot of capital stepping away from that in, you know, what I'd call the kind of more sensitive, bright light ESG, so banks and large traders who are putting out their glossy annual reports, you have this massive amount of private capital, which might have some requirements from LPs to avoid certain industries, but for the most part is pretty profit seeking. And so when you raise the cost of capital that, you know, X, the ESG concerns are pretty good businesses, you're actually encouraging a lot of that private capital to flow in and potentially make some of these things much better businesses to provide capital. Albeit there is an entire group of people who are shunning that and saying, we are happy to leave that money on the table. So within what we're seeing in the public sector or public companies, there's probably, I would imagine, going to be private capital that is going to direct its focus there.
Yeah, look, I think we've seen a massive misallocation of capital once more, because, you know, what probably should have taken a long time to occur tried to happen in a couple of years. And already, as most people are aware, in the commodity space, there have been massive underinvestment since the bust of 2014. So you had this area that was starved of capital. And then you had policy being set effectively by institutional capital rather than policymakers. And as a result, again, we got yet further neglect. And so now we've got this gaping hole where effectively we've got in our energy, we've got a duration mismatch. So it's just like any other liquidity crisis that potentially becomes a solvency crisis. It was one thing happening at a different pace than to the other thing. And therefore, there's a massive gap that was found. And that massive gap was, we've got a hole in our energy pocket and we need to go back into certain amounts of fossil fuel to make sure that we can get through. And then there's been a super spanner thrown into that works recently with what's going on in Ukraine. So it's an interesting world that, it's always this sort of dangerous thing. It was a bit like in the 1970s when there was this massive anti-nuclear movement, which probably meant we kept on fossil fuels much longer than we wanted to. So the unfortunate reaction or result of trying to be green in the 1970s is actually we became less green further down the road. We're sort of making that mistake, of making that mistake again by trying too quickly to change to something which is not yet ready. And the irony being is the good intentions end up being a very, very bad result. So I think there's got to be a look at that and a look at resetting that clock, unfortunately, to be something which can cope with what is quite clearly now one of the potentially the biggest issues that I've seen in my lifetime, and I've been around for half a century now. So, you know, it's a lot of problem.
Sure. And then just jumping back, one commodity in particular I want to touch on, which I think potentially has greater ramifications than other, is wheat. You know, Ukraine and Russia supply a significant amount of global wheat. And I believe the planting season was due to start at some point within the next couple of weeks. So not only will we have potential issues this season, but this may be something that carries forward. Unlike gas, which while it is sensitive for people at the pump and it does cause potential inflation and social unrest, the marginal buyer of wheat has to feed themselves and they will pay whatever they need. And if we look back through history, a lot of people have really pinpointed the inflation in food prices as the kind of key spark for the Arab Spring. And so already we've seen Egyptian sovereign bonds take a real tumble. And it does look like across the CDS market, you're seeing actually increasing risk being priced amongst a bunch of economies that otherwise should be doing really well because they're net oil exporters. So I wanted to touch on that and get your sense of how you think that could play out and whether potentially the government reaction could be different specifically to that commodity, either with respect to a coordinated action or relaxing requirements because of the nature of the importance of feeding people.
Yeah, I mean, on the wheat thing, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is the crucial element to it, but it really just goes back to a lot of countries are absolutely reliant on wheat, which means they're absolutely reliant on these supply chains. And once again, it's the supply chains that are going to be found wanting, not only the ability to plant and then harvest, but to actually get it out of the country and effectively out of the Black Sea, where apparently shipping is very, very limited at the moment. Now, obviously, the harvest season is in a few months' time. But it is significant. And as you said, we've seen uprisings before on the back of food prices. In China, food prices are one thing that they're always worrying about. When they had the wiping out of swine herd a couple of years ago, causing, you know, pork inflation to go to 100%, that was their highest priority. So food is the highest priority for a very large number of countries around the world. So again, it's unknowable, but it's a pretty serious situation, which could lead to significant forms of unrest in a lot of other parts of the world. Well, great. Thanks very much, Freddie, for that that quite wide-ranging conversation, particularly on the supply chains. But great to have you on again. And hopefully we'll have some more updates on this in the coming weeks.
Thanks for joining us, Roger. Really great to have you on Zeroes.